Thank you. Well, it's a great honor to be invited to speak at this birthday meeting, and I thank the organizers for the opportunity. Basically, this whole talk is about a debt of gratitude I owe to Jim and the community for sparking off, in some way, in some times, and in some circumstances, perhaps unknowingly, developments in theoretical physics which have turned out, after a long period of time, to be of central interest to a large proportion of the community. So when I illustrate the talk, I will illustrate the talk by telling you about papers that Jim has written which have spurred off my own modest efforts. But that's only because of the shortage of time and because I wanted to be concrete. But in some of the fields I'm talking about, the number of contributions is very large. I'll explain in detail the 55 number that comes up here. Okay, so I think this is supposed to give me the next slide. And the first remark is, it really does seem just a short while ago that I spoke at a celebration we had in Cambridge. It was actually not organized by us, but it was organized at the Newton Institute, to which Jim was a visitor. And I still have the, well, this is a slide, or a JPG made, of my transparencies. So I spoke about the Einstein equations and the rigidity of quantum mechanics. And there you see the date, 1999. I'll come back to that topic later in the talk. But what I said at that meeting, to begin with, is my admiration of his mastery of the twin peaks of general relativity and quantum mechanics. Twin Peaks was, I think, a fashionable TV program. So it came into my mind that I should use that phrase just to wake up the audience. And here are the Twin Peaks, again taken from my overpoint, which are basically geometry, manifolds, general relativity in its physical manifestations, of course, and quantum mechanics with its states, Hilbert spaces, operators, and observables. And Jim, I think, amongst all the people of his generation, certainly, was one of the first to realize that to understand physics at a deep level, you've got to master both. When I started as a graduate student, you were either a particle physicist or an astrophysicist or something like that. Now I think everybody would agree, of course, you have to specialize, but there's no real difference between the two subjects. We are in the process, which had hardly begun when Jim began his work, of pushing those two peaks together to make them a single unified peak. Okay, so now what I want to explain is the mysterious number 55, because on looking back through, first of all, the title is taken from a well-known play of Alan Bennett, which is 40 years on, which is about a bunch of schoolboys who then are 40 years older talking about the old days, which is, roughly speaking, I think, the remit that we're given by the organizers. Okay, 55. Now, having heard Kip's talk, I realize it's not quite accurate to say it was 55. But anyhow, let me go on to what I wanted to start doing. So I'm going to go through a few topics in which Jim has pioneered things in the more theoretical aspects of general relativity. I won't be covering the topics that Kip has taught, but there will be inevitably some overlap. So this paper was published in 64, but as which I didn't know before I came here, as Kip has told us, the work goes back much further to Jim's undergraduate and graduate years. I put this paper has been cited at least 111 times, simply to say that it's still of interest today, and I'll explain why shortly. Okay, so the gion was described to us by Kip. It was one of the ideas that came out of John Wheeler's work revitalizing general relativity in just shortly after the death of Einstein. And initially it was thought to be a self-gravitating system of photons moving in closed orbits and self-gravitating and holding itself together. And we heard a beautiful description this morning, which I knew I didn't know was going to be given, of how that works. So there are a number of issues which arise from that, some of which Kip mentioned. But the thing I'd like to mention, and it came much later, and it came much later because physics had changed in the intervening period in a way that I'll explain. The point is that we can now try to understand this from a more rigorous point of view. Do these gluons actually exist? So let's suppose that we're dealing with pure vacuum gravity. We can add other fields. The answer is that there are some theorems available to us now, which were not apparent at the time, that if you have an asymptotically flat system, which is periodic or quasi-periodic, by quasi-periodic, I mean, simply mean it goes up and down, any of the field variables, near infinity, it must, under rather general circumstances, be stationary. And the reason is not hard to see. The point is that if you've got a system which moves, then even gravitational waves, gravitational waves gravitate. So they will emit gravitational radiation. In other words, there will be inevitably a Bondi mass loss, and that Bondi mass loss contradicts, because it's monotonic, contradicts the possibility of a periodic source, or even a quasi-periodic source. It brings about inevitably a secular behavior of the fields. Now, actually, I got interested in this much later than that paper, although I knew of the paper, because John Stewart and I were invited to give a talk at a meeting which had the rather amusing title, Classical General Relativity, Proceedings of the Conference on Classical Brackets Non-Quantum, in other words, General Relativity. Well, that's what it was like in 83. The old school were getting nervous, all this quantum mechanics, so let's get rid of it. And what we proved, at least we had a proof which had a lacuna, which I'll come to shortly, was that this theorem. It was done in a way which imitates a well-known theorem of Stephen Hawking, which is that if you have a stationary black hole, it's got to have an axial symmetry, at least in four dimensions. And the idea was to use, in the case of Stephen's theorem, the event horizon as a characteristic surface for the Einstein equations, and show that the initial data necessarily had a symmetry moving you up and down in a certain direction. And that's because technically the initial data satisfied equations like the Rayquard-Heary equation, and the Rayquard-Heary equation is a classical standard example of an equation which doesn't have periodic solutions. It blows up in finite time or is constant. So this involved, in our case, using as characteristic surface future null infinity, and we used a formulation of Einstein's equations which were worked out by Helmut Friedrich, in which you think of constructing solutions in terms of a Cauchy surface at infinity. So the paper was submitted to the proceedings, and later these three authors found a gap in the reasoning which they were able to repair. They extended it to electrovacuum and also scalars. Why was this in fact, another technical point for those that know about this is that Stephen's theorem relied on allaticity of the data, and so did we, but a recent work by a pure mathematician appears to have removed even the dependence on allaticity. So why did I get interested in this subject? Well, you see, in 1983, people started getting interested in classical solutions of quantum field theories, the most well-known being magnetic monopoles. And so they wanted to know whether there were classical lump solutions and similar things, but they also wanted to know whether or not there were stable bound states, which were sometimes called breathers. And the question is, I was asking myself, and we were asking ourselves, is could you have breathers in general relativity? And the answer is, broadly speaking, in the asymptotically flat situation, no. But to show the interest of this topic, I can remind the audience who don't know that Gary Horovitz and Jorge Santos have turned to the same problem in ADS, asymptotically ADS backgrounds recently, and have given cogent reasons for expecting that gions may exist in this situation. So it's been a long time since 1964, but there is a good hope, or at least a good reason for believing in gions in a way that was not initially envisaged. Okay, so what are we doing next? Okay, the next paper that in this particular area that I want to discuss is the idea of long-range neutrino forces. I think this paper is unappreciated and we don't talk about it a great deal now, but it is vital for our understanding of black holes that black holes have, as Wheeler described it, no hair. And what would it mean for a black hole to have neutrino hair? Well, it would mean that if I had a black hole here and a black hole here, that a long-range force between them would be exchanged by neutrinos moving from one black hole to another. And this long-range neutrino forces were developed by Feinberg and Suchet in this paper of 68. And Jim's beautiful paper launches into this by computing them in a black hole background and finds that there aren't any. And related work was done by Claudio Teitelbaum at the same time on the non-measurability of the lepton number of a black hole. So these were done specifically for the Schwarzschild case, but it's fundamental, I think, to our whole understanding of the black hole properties of black holes that it shouldn't be restricted in any way if we can possibly show it that that's true. And some years later, in this paper, which is moderately recent, I put these ideas, I was thinking about something else, working with a student, Claude Warnick, who's now on the faculty in Damt, in a more universal context. We hear a lot recently about the near horizon geometry of particularly extreme black holes, but the near horizon geometry of non-extreme black holes is equally interesting. And it's really the near optical geometry. So if you have a static black hole, you can write the metric like this, taking out the modulus of GTT. And then this is an ultrastatic metric. And the geodesics of this metric are null geodesics of the full metric by the conformal invariance of null geodesics. But they obviously project to geodesics of this metric, so we get back to the familiar optical metric. Now, simply because GTT vanishes in the near the horizons, it turns out that the near horizon metric tends exponentially in optical distance to the metric on Lobachevsky space or hyperbolic space, with a radius of curvature given by the inverse surface gravity. Well, we're talking about massless Dirac equations, which are conformally invariant. So we can work on this background space and study the massless Dirac equation in hyperbolic space or Lobachevsky space, and then study what happens if we have a source which recedes to the horizon, and we stay at fixed distance and measure the neutrino field. So that involves the Green's function. It's the same calculation that Jim did, but it has a nice kind of interpretation. This is like doing astronomy in Lobachevsky space, because the horizon is the boundary. And what is true in Lobachevsky space is that the multiple moments fall off very rapidly. There's no angular discrimination. So angular sizes disappear, and in fact what that means in this terms, and you can compute it explicitly with Green's functions, is that you lose all but the total averaged angular behavior as the object recedes towards the horizon. So that's another example of how Jim's insights contributed to our writing this paper. We studied his paper quite carefully and were able to obtain the result by explicit computation in the simplest case, because you see this is a universal behavior near the horizon, where at least if it's a spherical horizon or something of that sort. If it's not spherical, it's pretty universal. I mean, it's as universal as the ADS-CFT correspondence is basically the point for those that have followed that discussion. Okay, now I want to talk about classical black holes in more detail. And the time I first met Jim, I'm going to talk about the first time when, I think it was the first time, Jim used to visit IOTA, the Institute of Theoretical Astronomy in Cambridge, where Stephen Hawking used to be working at that time. Stephen had an office in Dampton, one in the Institute of Astronomy, and I was a graduate student, and that's when I first met him, as far as my best recollection is. They wrote two papers there. The first was mentioned earlier, which is on energy and angular momentum flow into a black hole. I didn't know it was going to be described, but it has been done so beautifully and elegantly that I'll say very little more about it. And this gave rise to at least two of Jim's papers. So that was the fruit of part of that summer. But another one, which they wrote a paper on the solutions of the Einstein-Maxwell equations with many black holes. And this impressed me very deeply. They showed that these there were solutions. They'd been known locally due to Papapetrou and Majumdar since the mid-40s, but they analyzed the horizon structure and so forth, showed that they were smooth solutions. And I can't remember now whether they conjectured that they were unique, but there have been many papers since proving that they're unique. Indeed, I had a go at doing this myself in the special case of axisymmetry, but I think there are much more general arguments. Now, this must have seemed rather arcane to people like Kip, because we know that objects don't have massive charges, and these needed a charge in natural units equal to the mass. So this was just some theorist playing around.
Oh, I love theorists playing around.
But what I claim is the true significance of their work would only become clear somewhat after the invention of supergravity. So here's where we're getting into the quantum world. I'll explain how that works out later. A much greater impact was received, of course, by one of Jim's greatest papers, most influential in the from the point of view of fundamental theory, I won't say in astrophysics. And that's when Stephen stayed at Caltech at the invitation of Kip. He had this special, what's the name of the, I've forgotten it, Fairchild scholarship or fellowship. And that was very predictive, very productive for Stephen, and a very happy time that he had there.
It was 74 to 75.
What?
Stephen was there.
Oh, I'm sorry, it's 74, 75. I beg your pardon. Yeah, no, that's a typo. Thank you for correcting me, yeah. I think he met there Don Page, for example. And one of his interesting ideas was the idea of a black hole in equilibrium with its products, which was rather radical at the time, I must say. And he wanted to understand how this equilibrium could be maintained. And I don't know the full history of how the paper was written, but he and Jim gave an entirely new derivation of the Hawking black hole radiance, using ideas very similar to the fundamental ideas of Einstein about thermal equilibrium, calculating the A and the B coefficients and showing they satisfied the appropriate condition. Now, this paper, I think, was a complete technical tour de force, and the importance was that he introduced, and I think this was really Jim that did this, path integrals. So I can't ask Stephen any longer, but I didn't hear Stephen talk much about path integrals before at that point. And in fact, more than that, their evaluation in terms of paths which are deformed into the complex plane. So this has been a key point. It's quite well explained in that book I heard, which we had as undergraduates, and it wasn't so tough after all, I think. But it's a staple of mathematical physics, of course, that we do this for finite dimensional integrals. That we can extend it to infinite dimensional integrals is to some extent an act of faith, but if we believe that act of faith, it's a very effective way of grasping instantaneously, almost, the elements of the problem at hand. We're going to hear more about this, I think, from Neil Turok, so I'm not going to say anything about the evaluation of path integrals. Oops, what do I want? Okay. Now, when Stephen came back, as you correctly say, it was 75, he talked about this, and it became clear to us, and by us I mean myself and Malcolm Perry, that they apply far beyond the level of linear QFT in a fixed background, and could even be extended at the semi-classical level to quantum gravity. So this is where Jim and Stephen's work opened up the route for understanding non-perturbative physics. And this chimed in very well with the atmosphere at the time, because the solutions that I was telling you about of classical equations of motion were an attempt to understand the non, which the field theorists and the particle physicists were interested in, were an attempt to understand non-perturbative quantum field theory. But what you can do with any field theory, you can do with a field theoretic view of general relativity. Doesn't mean to say you can renormalize it, but the ideas follow fairly straightforwardly. And it was also a coincidence at that time that what are called thermal Green's functions were being studied, not just by condensed matter physicists, you've known them for a long time, but by particle physicists. There were papers about field theory at finite temperature, the reason being people were interested in asymptotic freedom, and they were interested in the behavior of the equation of state, for example, for a Yang-Mills theory at high temperature. So the key point about working at high temperature, this is a fundamental rule of quantum mechanics, really, is if you're interested in the Gibbs state, you should be interested in correlators which have an analytic continuation to the complex plane, which is periodic in imaginary time. And that's exactly what Hartle and Hawking had discovered in their epoch-making paper. That's not how they quite described it. What they did to compute the ratio of the A to the B coefficient is to move a contour up what turns out to be one period and find that it acquires an exponential factor of the usual sort. So I first heard about the idea of finite temperature Green's functions from a talk that Malcolm Perry was giving. He's a student of Stephen's, but he wasn't working with Stephen at that time because Stephen was in California. He was working with a postdoc called John Collins, who has for a long time had a faculty position here in the US, who was a quantum field theorist, and they were working on the equation of state of dense matter at high temperature, because this was the epoch in which people had discovered asymptotic freedom, and so they could use the idea of a asymptotically free gas, that would give you an equation of state, which was energy density. Sorry, pressure is a third of the energy density. Up to that point, there were many speculations about what the equation of state should be at high density, and there was a famous Hagedorn equation of state, which is very popular. But if you believe in asymptotically free field theories, you're immediately led to that result, and that's the result that Malcolm and John Collins published. And I remember asking him at the back of the hall, can you tell me whether these Green's functions you're using are periodic in imaginary time? And he didn't know. he kind of knew, I think, but I went off and we worked it out. But that led to a whole slew of papers with Stephen and Malcolm and myself on what's come to be called the Euclidean theory of quantum gravity. But all of that really stems from that productive year that Stephen had in Caltech and from the interaction he had with Jim, because I don't think he would have gone in that direction. It took somebody from the outside who got a slightly different view of things. I can't assert that because we can no longer ask Stephen, but that was my impression talking with him. Okay, so now what do we do next? Oh, particle production in cosmology. This was another topic that Jim turned to. This was quite popular at the time. Zeldovich and his team were very keen on trying to understand this. And Leonard Parker and Stephen Fulling kicked off the interest. This precedes the particle production work that I mentioned earlier by black holes. In a way, these papers, although they post-date, well, I'm talking about this one here of Jim's, Jim was also interested in applying this path integral quantization to cosmological particle production. Now again, this is one of these things that didn't quite work at the time, but has come back enormously, of course. Our current understanding of inflation and the origin of matter after inflation is based precisely on looking at a quantum field theory in a curved background, but it's a very special one. It's in de Sitter space, and one can argue that the fundamental calculations that people are doing from day to day on this basically go back to this paper of Jim's, which contributed to and many others by Zeldovich and his group, which contributed to this paper, which wasn't directly concerned with inflation. And indeed, I remember thinking, well, this is a Gedanken, but it's not very realistic at that time. There was no way that that you could think of this as a large-scale cosmological constant. And even now, we cannot really think of the cosmological constant we see at large scales, or the approximate cosmological constant, in these terms. So I must say, I was really gobsmacked when I heard about the fact they were using these ideas. You were there as well at that meeting, right? And I thought, well, that's crazy. But it's rather satisfying, because you see, every stupid idea, if it's got a core of truth in it, it'll come out in the end. That's my message. And I'm not saying that Jim's had a lot of stupid ideas, but he's had a lot of ideas which have come out good in the end. Now, what about supergravity? After this period, in fact, why I didn't pay a lot of attention to that meeting, although I had to organize part of it, is that I had become deeply immersed in supergravity. So I'm now going to discuss supergravity and how Jim's work has a peripheral connection with this time. So at that time, supergravity was the one most attractive theory, at least in my view, for a quantum theory of gravity. It was clear that we couldn't quantize the ordinary gravitational field, at least with standard perturbative methods. And also it had beautiful properties. Mathematically, it's really a miraculous extension of Einstein's theory. If Einstein had been around and understood spinners, he would have wept with joy to see it. I don't know that he ever did much on spinners. He did a little bit, I think. But, okay. As I said, at this time, a lot of things became clear and a lot of these sort of speculative ideas came in. Quantum field theorists, as I said, are becoming very interested in non-perturbative solutions like non-abelian magnetic monopoles, or more generally, solitons, which had topological charges. And this is the key point. They were also interested in the breathers, as I alluded to earlier. And it's in this context that Stevens and Jim's Majumdar Papapetru solutions re-enter and take center of the stage. So the two 1940s papers are here listed. I think those are correct. And apparently independently, I don't think that. I should say actually at this point that in Jim's original paper with Stephen, they also mentioned the Israel Wilson solutions. And parenthetically, for those that know, they formed a key to understanding gravitational instantons later. They're not relevant for black holes because Jim and Stephen showed that they're singular, but they are relevant if you choose a particular case. So what is the importance of SUSY? Well, the most important paper for me was the paper of Witten and Olive. They'd argued that in supersymmetric theories, in flat space, topological charges are central. Now, this is a difficult idea to get over, and I want to put it in terms which relativists may understand. A charge is the guy which commutes or has an algebraic relation with the Hamiltonian and the other generators of the theory. To say it's central is to say it commutes with everything, and that means it's conserved. But that's not really the main point about central charges in supersymmetric theories. Central charges in supersymmetric theories, they showed, and it's not very difficult, they're such that the anticommutator of P is equal to, sorry, the anticommutator of the central charges is P plus an extra term, which commutes with everybody else. And if you look at that anticommutator and look in the rest frame, you'll see that you get an inequality called the Bogomolny bound after Bogomolny, or sometimes BPS after Bogomolny, Prasad, and Sommerfeld, which says that the mass or energy is bounded below by that central charge, and some magic happens if they're equal. So the magic at the technical level means that you get equality if and only if the solutions are time independent and satisfy first order equations, now known as the killing spinner equations. These solutions admit very special solutions of the Dirac equation or a modified Dirac equation. They basically have something which is almost coherently constant. And the integrability conditions for those are the second order equations. It's a beautiful situation which was unraveled by Olive, Witten and others at that time. But it also comes with the necessary idea that you will expect multi-solutions. Multi-solutions because these things, if you just place them, exert no force. Because if they did, there would be a solution of lower energy. So that's the relevance of the bound. And so when you look at this, you realize that there's something obvious here. The obvious thing is that, you need to know one thing, I guess, that the theory of Einstein and Maxwell, when you combine it, is in fact a supergravity theory, a so-called ungauged supergravity theory. And that's about all you need. But it also has central charges. And the reason goes back to your teacher Wheeler, you know, because Wheeler was always talking about charge trapped in the topology of space. It's nothing to do with the field. If you take pure Maxwell theory, it carries no charge. There's no interactions in pure Maxwell theory. So how can something have a charge? Well, it has to be topology. And that's what Misner and Wheeler were talking about in their wormhole business and all the rest of it. So you see there's a dictionary between what was current in the late 50s, was it early 60s? And what was current later. You can more or less write it out. So I pointed this out in various places, and it's now part of a much larger structure, which I will allude to later. Wait a minute, I'm getting back. Yeah, so I was lucky enough to acquire a talented graduate student, and we worked out all the details, at least in the Einstein-Maxwell case. So we have the kind of dictionary, we have that breather and geon should be thought of as the same idea. And central charge is the same as a charge without charge, because the fields don't carry that charge. And BPS, well, that admits a killing spinner. And supersymmetric, another key idea here, is zero temperature. Because it's quite clear that if you're in the Gibbs state, then you have a distinction between fermions and bosons. One has a Fermi-Dirac distribution and the other has Bose-Einstein. So this has been the foundation of ideas in not only in supergravity theory, it can be extended in a straightforward way to all of the ungauged supergravity theories, but it caught on in string theory and membrane theory much later. Oops. Now I'm going to turn to something which will be discussed in much greater detail later. By the way, how much time do I got?
Well, you're sort of into your question period.
Oh, okay.
You're 5 more
minutes. Okay, thank you. Sorry about that. It's the wave function of the universe. Now, I'm not going to talk a great deal about this, only to record that Jim and I wrote at least we only wrote one paper together, despite this enormous influence. Perhaps that's because I didn't have the talent to persist with all these lasting calculations. Anyhow, which is related to the wave function of the universe and has to do with what space-times can you construct for which you can really do that Wick rotation and analytically continue. I won't labour that in detail. But, did I really mean to say that? Yes. I won't go over this now because time is pressing. But that paper had some uses in the future. Okay, so now I want to talk about fine-tuning, and the only thing I'm going to say here is that one of the issues that Jim and others have looked at and which are still very important, is how you give a measure on on the set of wave functions or a measure on the set of initial conditions. I just want to record that I told you that the talk I gave had a rather unusual title in the 60th anniversary, and it was about the complex structure of state space in quantum mechanics. And this was also inspired by these considerations. Leo Grischuk, sadly now passed, asked me what was a typical wave function for the universe. So I'm asking myself, what's this Russian phrase they're using? And of course, if you know about quantum mechanics, typical means a density matrix. So what's going on here? Well, it's easy with a two-state system to convince yourself that a random density matrix corresponds to uniform measure on the Bloch sphere. And so if you ask yourself what's a density matrix in higher dimensions, it's a uniform measure on what's known as complex projective space. So that was the subject of the talk that I gave long ago, and what's the result? It certainly is very interesting to understand quantum mechanics in this geometrical way. And I commend it to you, Jim. Okay. So I've come to the end. I just want to make a remark about Jim himself. He's been a scientific inspiration to myself and so many others, but also he and Mary Jo have been gracious and considerate hosts during the visits that I and my family have paid to Santa Barbara, revealing the many hidden gems to be found here. One such gem is Lotus Land, where you took us some time ago. And Lotus Land, for those who don't know, it is full of exotic plants, Japanese gardens and things. Really is worth seeing. Here are just a few of the exotic cactuses and succulents that they have. So, let me see. That's another piece. This is Jim, who looking contemplative, I think. Does it inspire you, this beautiful garden? I'm sure it does. Here's Mary Jo, my wife, Christine. And I just want to conclude with a message from us both. Happy birthday on August 20th, if I may put it that way, from Gary and Christine. Happy birthday, Jim. And many, many thanks.
So we have time for a question or two if the audience has some. Yes, Neil?
To a long-range force?
Well, the point is that when you look at the... it's a calculation, but what you find is you get exponential force fall-off of the propagator, And the propagator, the scalar propagator goes as an exponential, and the, you can obtain the spinner propagator essentially by differentiation. But the point is that everything goes off exponentially. You don't get power laws. These forces which are which work for genuine atomic systems or nuclear systems are due to multiple moments which fall off as power laws in flat space. So there's a power law which I can't remember now which gives this force law. Well, actually, the idea still works, because basically all the mass terms get smaller and smaller the closer you get to the horizon. So for the no-hare theorems, you can ignore the mass theorems, the mass terms, if your source. You see, you're already interested, you take your source, which moves closer and closer to the horizon, it's held at rest, of course, and you just look what we see here. And they will just, because they're going to, first of all, they're going to infinity in this conformally related space, and secondly, they're going exponentially fast, I mean, down.
Question for Gary? All right, well, thank Gary again.